Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. Thanks a lot for all of the feedback and emails and messages that I've got since the last episode and generally just since the new year. It's been really interesting. Lots of people have got book reviews, have been sending me them in, like email me luke@juggler.net with anything like that. But also just some general feedback, and I've had some really good discussions with people. Lots of people have been listening to, you know, lots of people like the Ayn Rand Atlas Shrugged review last time, and other people have been keep going back, and it seems more and more people are joining the podcast and going back through and listening to all of the previous episodes, or a lot of the previous episodes. Episode number 100 is still a favorite, and there's other episodes that come up now and again. Episode 61, I think, is one that people email me about quite often. If you listen to that, you'll probably understand why. The good thing to do is actually now, I think iTunes only has the last 100 episodes in the feed, but if you go to sfbrp.com, there's a list on there of every episode ordered by, you know, just release date, and also by rating, and also by author as well, so you can check through with the books that you like, or books that you want to check out, you know, my favorite books or least favorite books that I've reviewed, depending on what you want to have. Also, like I say, keep sending in the emails, because I do reply to every single email, and I've been having some good conversations lately, as I said. And like I say, every email, except if you're really crazy, because this is the thing that comes up when I do a review of a book like Atlas Shrugged. Lots of people said, hey, really enjoyed it, you hit the nail dead on and stuff like that. One person, I made a note over here, Anthony, said, I just finished listening to your review of Atlas Shrugged. What a relief. I was afraid that you were going to love it, and then I was going to have to boycott your podcast. Just joking, that's from Anthony. And there's been quite a few good emails about that, except... you know, one person started, there's only been one person to get back to me and say, oh no, I think you're all wrong about this. Actually, some people said, look, you dismissed the philosophy a bit too abruptly, maybe you should read up on it further. To be honest, I read up on it, I think, enough. I don't really need to go into it too much, I don't think. There's lots and lots of different life philosophers out there, and you know, I'm not that much into philosophy that I need to give that one a huge amount of thought. I know I was probably misrepresenting it slightly, but hey, you know, everything's a little bit more complicated than it is at first glance. Anyway, one person tried to defend it, but they did say in such a weird way that at first I thought, you know, oh, that's great, you know, he disagrees with me. And he did bring up a big point about me saying that, you know, I was contrasting the USA and China. And he said, well, you can't contrast them, they're part of the same system. And I said, well, that's true, you know, no problem at all about that. And then he went off on one, and I suddenly thought it was a joke. And then I realized it wasn't a joke, how much he was into defending his point of view or his politics. And you know, I actually said something in my review about moving to Somalia, and he sent me a link to a study showing that the average Somalian is better off now than they were before the government collapsed. And I was just like, yeah, great. So you pick one of the worst governments in the world, in one of the worst places in the world, worst by, you know, many different measures here. And then once the government collapsed, there's a slight improvement. That's just called regression to the mean. It means that once something gets as low as it possibly can, it's very difficult for it not to go up slightly. Anyway, so one of his first emails that he sent me, I'm not going to name the guy, he said, the whole point of a free market system is that it compels, via the invisible hand, even the worst people to benefit society. And I just, you know, I read that, and I, you know, it was at the beginning, I thought it was joking. But then I was just like, there's so much wrong with that one sentence. I said, look, I could pick apart everything that you said just on that sentence, and most of the sentences, and most of the emails that you're sending, because it got, you know, his arguments devolved into sending me emails with pictures of piles of gold on them. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. So, but that one sentence really sums up so much. Well, actually, let me just break it down. So, point by point, fuck it, I'll do it. So, like, I didn't do this in the email, but I might as well do it now because I don't actually have to write it down. So he goes, the whole point of a free market system. Okay, take that one part. Reductive thinking. Just remember, you know, the t-shirt design. I think you'll find it's more complicated than that. You can't have the whole point of a free market system condensed down into a single sentence. You know, that doesn't work like that. You know, next bit is that it compels. And I'm thinking, okay, this is from someone who said that compelling anyone to do anything against their will is bad. And that if the government compels you to do anything, it's bad. You know, like paying taxes, that's really bad. But then I'm just thinking, if the political system that you want to get set up, you know, the free market system, means that the only way you know, to get by isn't through force from the government, which I think is a, you know, a straw man argument anyway, but the only way to get by is to starve or die or become a slave. I'm saying, you know, and that's the compelling thing. So it's okay, we're not going to force you out of violence, but we are going to force you out of, you know, just not giving you any money. And I'm charitable and stuff like that. No, that's not the way it works. You know, you can't rely on that kind of stuff. So yeah, compelling in one way, bad, compelling in the other way. Then it goes via the invisible hand, you know, and I like this invisible hand kind of thing, which is great because it's an invisible hand. It's like unquantifiable. And, you know, the Austrian school of economics actually says, oh, look, we can't predict anything. There's no point in predicting anything. We just got to go for it. So it's an invisible, unguided, like unstudiable, unplannable forehand as well, like that. And that's actually what happens in Atlas Shrugged as well. New technologies come up and, you know, old technologies die off. And suddenly people who did have a source of income no longer have a source of income. So it's great. So this invisible, unguided, you know, hand, it's just a bit strange. And that wasn't because of the evil government or anything like that. No, it was actually, you know, business models collapsing and stuff like that. And then this is the worst part of the this is the most sticking out to me bit of this sentence. He goes even the worst people, you know, it compels even the worst people. And I'm just like, ouch. Okay, how do you define the worst people? Now, one way to look at it is the lazy people, you know. So the lazy people, you know, they're the ones who should be compelled to do more. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe if someone truly is lazy, maybe they should be compelled to do more rather than just sucking up with, you know, charity and stuff like that, or whatever, you know, relying on the system and things like that. It's like, yeah, okay, if laziness is the true factor, yeah, maybe you should be compelled to do something to get off of your ass and get a job or something like that. However, the laziness tag is something that's been put on, like, for generations. You know, the more powerful classes put, you know, call the lower classes or the least powerful classes lazy. You know, anyone who can't get a job is lazy. All these black people around here, they're lazy. All these unemployed people are lazy. And, you know, even Charlie in Flowers at Algernon was called lazy because he couldn't learn anything. His mother was going, oh, you're just being lazy. And it wasn't laziness. And I'm not saying black people are lazy, you know, in case you want to suddenly accuse me of racism. I'm saying this is the kind of rhetoric which is used by people with money, with power, to point at other people and say, look, we don't want to look after these people because they're lazy. Now, that's a straw man argument, because this sentence, it doesn't say lazy people, it says, you know, worst people. And I'm thinking, okay, so who are the worst people? If they're not lazy, who are the only people, I think, you know, the truly lazy could be compelled to do something or like encouraged to do something, even by an invisible hand. It's like, so who are the worst people? Are they the poor people? Are they the disabled people? Like the mentally disabled people? Maybe someone who's unskilled? Maybe someone who was skilled, but now their skill is no longer, you know, useful anymore? Maybe someone who's an orphan who doesn't, you know, someone who's got their parents broke up, widows, you know, who's the people who are looking after them, you know, died and stuff like that. Maybe just unemployed people who can't get a job. Maybe the economy goes down there. Are they the worst people? And I'm just thinking, so the worst people aren't, there's nothing bad about them, or, you know, qualitatively bad about them. I'm not quite sure how to say this, but it's just that they're unfortunate, you know, and there, by the grace of God, go I. Except, you know, I don't believe in God. So there, except that I was lucky growing up, go I, and stuff like that. And I'm just like, so suddenly, just because I'm slightly less fortunate or I didn't have the same opportunities in life, I'm suddenly the worst person or one of the worst people in society. And it's just that whole mindset which goes like that. Like, my father is disabled. He hasn't had a job in about, what, 27 or 28 years now or something like that? And many of those years he's been in a wheelchair. You know, he's kept alive by going to hospital every week and getting pumped full of drugs every week. Is he one of the worst people in society? I don't think so. You know, he might be a drain on society, but then again, he contributed a lot to society. You know, he was an officer in the army, and he is being looked after even now by pensions from being an officer in the army, you know. Sort of ties into today's review, maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'll bring it back in. And then at the end he goes, you know, it compels even the worst people to benefit society. And I'm like, okay, so this is great. I do think that capitalism is important for wealth creation. It's probably one of the best ways that we've come up with so far to create more wealth for people. However, it encourages the creation of wealth, but then that's not it, you know, because the wealth doesn't go to benefit everyone, you know. Well, let me get into that in a bit, but also the idea of that someone should be compelled to do something that benefits other people, I don't really see that holds true, because I do things all the time that don't benefit anyone except me. And guess what? That's awesome. Other people do things all the time just to hang out and not to benefit anyone. That's great. Now, you could say, oh, well, these people are spending money to, you know, to not benefit, and that puts it back into it. And it's like, yeah, okay, that is great. You know, that is part of, you know, capitalism, that, you know, the money goes around and all that kind of different stuff like that. But some people, maybe they don't want to benefit anyone. Maybe they just want to throw their money in a ditch. And it's like, well, great. Why not? Well, I'm not saying money in a ditch. Literally, I'm just saying that they can do something which doesn't, you know, doesn't benefit society. And I don't see why anyone shouldn't be able to do that, you know. And then they are also like the benefit society. Who is the society? Well, as far as we can tell from Atlas Shrugged and all of these different like economic models, generally society that's being benefited is the upper classes and the already rich people. Trickle-down economics is a nice idea. However, if the people at the top get their way, they want to put a dam across that trickling-down economic benefits and stuff. So, yeah, the trickles stop, and the gap between the rich and poor just grows. It didn't shrink. It doesn't shrink. It never shrinks. You know, very few times it does shrink. You know, sometimes, I guess, in some ways you can make it not shrink. But then again, hey, that's the way it goes. Anyway, I don't know a whole lot about economics, I must admit. But, you know, I didn't want to continue an email discussion with anyone with such a disregard for other humans, like, who don't want to... It's like people pay taxes and national insurance payments in the UK as well. If it was really so morally repugnant to the vast majority of people, or if it's intrinsically morally repugnant to have to pay taxes, which is backed up by the force of the government, you know, people would go on strike or not pay or protest or, you know, vote in other systems and stuff. But guess what? They don't do that. There might be lots of reasons for it. Again, it's a lot more complicated than I'm setting out now, but people pay their taxes and their national insurance contributions because they actually really do care about people like themselves and for themselves. And while everyone wants to pay less tax, you know, they end up paying taxes because they understand that everyone benefits from it, including them. And I, you know, and everyone gets sort of like at least a basic level of infrastructure to live in. You know, people pay taxes and they get the fire brigade, and they pay taxes and they get the police, and they pay taxes and they get schools. Even if the schools and the police and the fire brigade are a bit shit in some different cases, they understand the reasoning behind it. You know, some places you get a better deal, some places you get a worse deal. That is true. Anyway, more importantly, I didn't want to have an email discussion with someone who, like, despite the fact that they're crazy, you know, and they think that linking to photos of gold, you know, piles of gold constitutes a sound argument or a solid argument. You know, I don't want those people in power, let alone having a discussion with them and shaping future policy and stuff like that. Empathy and compassion are, I think, two of the most important human traits, especially if you read, was it Android's Dream of Electric Sheep? Decker, you know, if Decker tested the humanity of the objectivists and Ayn Rand, he would retire them from service for not being human enough, I think, you know, just because the complete lack of compassion. Anyway, that's enough of that. I just find it funny that I can talk about like this on my podcast rather than actually having to write it down in an email just to one person, because it's just not worth my time. But like I say, most people are really emailing. If you know, you know, if you actually have arguments or you actually want a discussion rather than you just want to convince me that Austrian system economics and objectivism is a good way to live my life or to think about the future, well, I was going to say, you actually have to give me some good arguments in that way. And it's always, you know, people send me arguments about books and arguments about things all the time. And I, you know, change my mind quite often. I've got no problem about that at all. Anyway, so today's book, Starship Troopers, Robert A. Heinlein, 1959, it says here, and 263 pages. And it's been a while since I finished this book, probably about a week since, because I actually finished it before I did the last podcast episode. But I thought, well, I won't record it and put it out straight away, because, you know, I might as well just space out the podcast a bit. And then I've just been super busy. I've been traveling a lot. I finished my trip up the Amazon. I went to Colombia, to Bogota, and then I went to the Caribbean. I spent a few days in the Caribbean, and I've just done a passage. I went to Costa Rica, which was really nice, and did a passage through the Panama Canal, my first ever trip through the Panama Canal. It's been a pretty good trip out. Anyway, so now I thought I should actually get around to doing this. I'll probably upload it in a few days' time. So yeah, I've read this book before, and I thought I'd do the complete set of, you know, the classic military science fiction novels that trace, you know, the story of the recruit through to fighting bugs and, you know, promotion in the end as well. Like, the, you know, this book pretty much set the mold for that. And then there was Joe Haldeman's Forever War, which is like a rebuttal of this book. And, you know, Joe Haldeman writing after his experience in Vietnam sort of had a different kind of journey in his, you know, that he wanted to write about rather than the sort of a idealized one that's set out here in Starship Troopers. And then there's Ender's Game, which has a different take on the same kind of young recruit bug hunting journey as well. And also I did review Old Man's War, which is sort of like not a classic by any means, but it does, you know, John Scalzi sort of does follow the same path with his protagonist there as well. Sort of dumbs down a lot about the ethics and the politics, and sort of goes for like, hey, war isn't that important. It's just a stupid game between civilizations, and, you know, and concentrates on the more of the sort of, what's the attitude? Like, America, fuck yeah, you know, kind of aspect of what's like, yeah, let's go, we've got guns, we've got, you know, and the actual sort of ethics and politics and all the other stuff sort of goes into a little bit of second place there rather than about, hey, check out this cool stuff. I mean, there is more to it than that. I'm not discarding everything that he does in there thematically. I'm saying it doesn't really stand up compared to these other three books that I'm going to talk about. Anyway, Starship Troopers, set in a world in the far future. Human beings spreading among the stars encountered other species out in the galaxy, sort of variably get on with some of them quite well, and otherwise sometimes they've got to fight for territory or something like that. Now, that's sort of like the background. Really, another part of the political background is this, is that one of the main ideas is that not everybody is allowed to vote, or able to vote. Only those who have volunteered for military service and for at least 2 years of some kind of federal military kind of service, they can vote. And everyone else merely pays their taxes and is not a full citizen. Or they are a full citizen, but they're not, a full voting citizen, if you get my drift there. I get more into the sort of like that idea later on. But so this, about the thematic idea of that later on. But the idea of the society is like this is weird patriarchal society with everything is run by sort of old army officers who have been, you know, now turned into politicians or teachers or, you know, all that kind of stuff like that. Otherwise, the world is sort of, everyone is very equal, except of course male and females, which I'll get onto later. But like racially, everyone is equal. Johnny or Juan from Chile, Johnny Rico is from Chile, but, you know, later on we discover he's some kind of minority within his own country, some kind of, South American Indian Inca kind of stock there. I'm not entirely sure. I can't remember exactly what it says there. It's been a week since I read this or finished this book, maybe more actually, probably about 10 days. So anyway, yeah, that's what it's set up. The setting though is it's tiny bit sort of in the wider world, but most of the action takes place inside like a marine training camp, you know, the mobile infantry training camp, and on board starships, and then on alien planets with the bug hunting stuff going on there as well. And I actually really quite enjoyed the world building. I'm not going to go into too much here because it's not that important, to be honest, because Heinlein really does have an eye for the key details, the important details, and I really mean the only important ones, because, you know, if there's star drives, doesn't really worry about that, you know, and all that kind of different stuff. A lot of it's not explained at all, but then he spends like pages and pages detailing like the military technology and the procedures and all this kind of stuff. And I know that he actually enlisted, I know he didn't see any action, you know, but Heinlein does know about the military, and of course he obviously let that influence his the way that his world works and is set up. But yeah, world building, pretty good. Like I say, a bit sparse on sometimes, but, you know, it gets across the point here. The story, also a little bit sparse. We start with a battle, just drops us right in it. And then we, sort of near the end of this battle, we have a flashback. And then we get this very simplistic story about Johnny, who is, he's just leaving school, not quite sure what he wants to do. His father owns a business, and Johnny could, if he wants to, just sort of walk into the business and work his way up quickly, and then just become the owner and manager of the business. But he wants to prove himself to himself and to the wider world and things like that. He's not really quite sure if he wants to join up, but in the end he does, and he's not quite sure what he wants to do in the army. But, you know, he's thinking, oh, I could do this or I could do that. I want to be a starship pilot, you know, and a friend of his goes and she joins up and becomes a starship pilot. And he's like, yeah, I want to do this. Or maybe I'll work with dogs. And a friend of his goes to work in his research, stuff like that. But it turns out he's a bit too stupid for all of that. So then he goes into the mobile infantry. And of course, once he's in the mobile infantry, he's like, oh, yeah, this is of course. This is the best thing. This is where I wanted to be all along. Yeah, let's gung ho. Like this. Which, of course, is just, I think, quite clever that as soon as he's in the military, all of his previous ideas of not wanting to be in the mobile infantry is suddenly thrown out, and suddenly that is the best place to go, and that's the only honourable place to go. The guys with the dogs, all the pilots and all that kind of stuff, yeah, they do a good job, but, you know, the mobile infantry is where it's really at, of course, where it's really at, even though at the beginning of the book he didn't think that, which I think is quite fun there. Goes to show how sort of dim and a bit dull the main character is. So then there's this bug war begins, and the flashbacks catch up, and then he starts officer training, and then, you know, there's this battle, the bug world at the end. Not really spoiling anything, because there's not a lot to spoil, because it is really that journey of a recruit going through, getting to the end, you know, being promoted along the way, that kind of stuff. We know the story from, well, Starship Troopers and all these other books that I've mentioned so far already. So the plotting, very basic, quite slow, actually. Things happen along the way that sort of steer Johnny along the path. He's quite passive in a way. But the thing is, he's the perfect soldier. He doesn't question anything. In doing so, he is happy. You know, when he gets an order, he does what he is told. And, you know, sometimes he makes mistakes. But along the way, he learns a lot about life and about the military and about politics and about ethics and stuff like that. But there's not really anything surprising going on. Actually, there are a few twists, but they don't involve him as a character. They always happen to somebody else, and or they, you know, they happen to him as well. But they really, you know, the main part of that twist is that someone else goes through a big change and stuff like that. But again, the book not really about the characters, which is good actually, because the characters are a bit flat and stuff like that. However, unlike, you know, Atlas Shrugged, where the hero is perfect from the beginning. Actually, all of the heroes are just perfect from the beginning. And or as far as I could tell, they just instinctively and intrinsically know what is good and what is right. And they just do the thing, and they're, you know, they're from a successful family and they just do it, that kind of stuff. This really isn't like that. This is someone who goes against what their father wants and goes against what their family wants for, you know, not great reasons sometimes, but he does find himself as a person. So there is sort of like that growing up kind of thing, rather than fully formed heroes being dropped into a world to interact with it like it was in Atlas Shrugged. So at least there is a bit of character growth there. Now, the other characters outside of Johnny, they sort of, the people who survive, this is a bit weird, the people who survive and stay within the system can work within the system, and the people who stay within the system survive and stick around, which means that everyone that Johnny meets has sort of a similar mindset, in the same way that we had in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Also, Mistress, oh, I knew I'd messed that up. You know, Heinlein writes these characters, and everyone who doesn't fit within like the political system there just gets thrown out the airlock. And here, whoever doesn't fit within the military mindset is just, you know, they leave or get kicked out or something like that, and they don't stick around, which means that the tone of the book, everyone that Johnny meets is sort of quite constant character-wise. You know, there are a few sort of dissenting voices and characters. You know, he meets these sort of merchant marine guys and stuff like that, you know, and he realizes that his position is not unassailable because they try to assail it, and all these different things going on. So, you know, there's like the hinted at different mindsets and thoughts and political ideals and ethical stuff like that. But generally, Johnny's only exposed to one kind of thing. Oh, and then, of course, we get onto the female characters, which sort of really does show off the worst side of Heinlein, because these other things that I'm saying are sort of, it's based within the story, if you understand what I mean. It's sort of like, yeah, he's quite a, you know, he's quite a dull kid, you know, and he's being manipulated by the system. He doesn't realise that, but he really is being manipulated by this quite sort of fascist system that's being put across in this book. And like I say, these other people that you get, the sort of one-sided thing that he is being, you know, programmed by his school and all that kind of stuff to be the person he is. But then the female characters, like I say, I never think that Heinlein, I don't know, it's just one of those things that I always suspect that Heinlein really is just a dirty old man. Like right at the beginning, you know, he goes to the recruiting office, Johnny, with Carmen, a girl from school, and him and his friend, I can't remember his friend now, but they go in, so there's the three of us there, and the recruitment officer just goes, "Hey, up, lovely, hey, look at that, oh, she's like nice, like that. Hey, guys, don't wait, I'll be with you in a moment, I just want to let you near over here." And then Carmen gets in, she goes off and wiggles her ass, and the guy's like, "Oh, look at that beauty, look at her ass, yeah, look at that, right. Ooh, yes, I could have a little bit of that. Some 18-year-old. Now, boys, what do you want?" And it literally is like that. He just dismisses the guy. It's quite. And then later on in the book, we often, you know, all the soldiers go down to this, you know, this idyllic planet for rest, and they go off and it's sort of like, oh yeah, and all the women came along and they saw to our needs, and I'm just like, you know, it's sort of like, the only function of women at this military retreat is to service the men. It's like a bit disgusting. Anyway, normally I wanted to just say, you know, expect Heinlein kind of, you know, expect the sexism, expect that it is in his book, which is always a bit disconcerting. It gets worse than this in other books, of course, but, you know, it's there. But it's a bit strange because when I talk about the technology... Oh, actually, I'm here already. Let me explain why the sexism is a bit weird, which I'll get onto in a minute. First of all, technology. Heinlein, designer and technician, it really shows off in his writing. He knows his stuff. He can think through all the problems and all the consequences of like a new technological invention. And that's the kind of my favourite part. Some of my favourite parts about his writing is that he can go, right, there's this invention. They do this and they do this. And then when you're out in the field, it's designed like this and this and this. And, you know, I enjoy that part at the beginning of Has Spacesuit Will Travel, where, you know, the main character is battling not against anything bad, but against bad spacesuit design. He's like, and when he gets even right at the very end of the novel, he's like, well, you know, I'd really like to become, you know, a spacesuit technician. And it's really good because the spacesuit, the design of the spacesuit and the you know, the building of the spacesuit itself actually has a name, Oscar, and it sort of talks back to him and actually becomes a character in the novel. And we sort of get that a bit here as well with the exoskeleton powered armor, which is, you know, awesome. You know, it's where we get the idea of the exoskeleton powered armor stuff in science fiction, you know, that kind of setup. I'm not saying was this the first time it was done? Well, I guess you get it a bit with the, like in the War of the Worlds with the walking machines and those things that the aliens put on and become more than they are, you know. So I guess it's got roots all the way back to there. But, you know, this is where you really go into detail about saying this is this and this is that. And also it's used sensibly. The whole idea of the mobile marines, the mobile infantry who go down in these powered armor things, it actually does make sense, like in a way that it doesn't with some other military science fiction that I've read, where, you know, example, Old Man's War, where they go down and fight, and you're just like, well, why are they going down? Why are they doing that? Why don't they just fight properly? You know, why are they trying to capture planets or something like that? And it's dealt with very well in Old Man, you know, well in Old Man's, not Old Man's War, Forever War as well. And also Ender's Game too, because the actual battles in that, it's all theoretical, isn't it? It's all taking place in computers and commanding starships, and it's not about infantry on the ground, even though they do, they train in person, one against one and man on, well, boy on boy or girl on girl or boy and girl and that kind of stuff. However, you know, the end result of that is going to be training for, you know, space battles and stuff where, you know, that's where you get, the power goes head to head. Whereas here, all of the exoskeleton powered mobile infantry, it's always like, you think, well, why not bomb for orbit? And it replies in the book, it's like, well, we're not going to do that because that's wasteful. And actually what we want to do is, you know, mobile infantry, it's for very specific uses. And it goes into quite a lot of detail how it works, you know, not just the not just how the suit works and how the, you know, the tactics works and how the firing ranges work and how they move across the countryside and stuff like that, but also the reason for deployment, like they go down you know they go down to the planet against the squigglers, let's call them. I can't remember the name of them, not the bugs, the other ones, the reedy thing. Can't remember the name. So yeah, they go down against them and say, oh, we're not coming down here to kill anyone, it's more sort of shock and awe tactics, we just want to destroy infrastructure and scare them very a lot. So that's what they do, you know, that kind of stuff. So it is actually quite well explained. Of course, like I say, at the beginning we see the orbital drops as well. You know, they set off, they get shot out individually, they get shot out of a spaceship, and then they go down and burn up, the outer layers of the shell burns up through the in the atmosphere as they're coming down to land on the ground, and then they, they have the parachutes, and then they get the jets and stuff like that, so coming down, really good stuff. But then I thought, you know, well, if these powered suits put so much power into the user, I'm like, well, why do all of the mobile infantry people have to be guys? Now, this doesn't, you know, it was just a random thought at this time, but then I was thinking, yeah, you know, because it even says in the book, you know, women are, you know, they're better at maths, well, not all of them, but, you know, it says that, and they're better at controlling at high speeds and better under pressure, and they, you know, they can deal with acceleration better too, just because they've got smaller bodies and stuff like that. And I'm thinking, well, if you're a mobile infantry guy and you have to do the drop, and, you know, everyone drops and stuff like that, but women don't, and I was thinking, well, maybe it's just about, you know, like, you know, the innate differences between men and women's sort of psychology that, you know, even Juan, Johnny in the book is told, hey, you're the kind of stupid guy who's stupid enough that people, you know, you'll be stupid enough to be enthusiastic enough that people will follow you into battle. But I can't, I'm too cynical, I'm too world weary. But you'd be great. And I'm thinking, well, maybe that's a comment on sort of like the mindset of males over females as well, that males are the ones who would be able to do that kind of stuff. So I'm thinking, okay, that's great. But then it explains that to become a leader, to become a commodore or commander or whatever it is, you know, I can't remember the military, you know, rank exactly what it says, general or whatever it is, you know, high up. It says you have to be both trained in the Navy and in the infantry before you can become a, you know, brigadier general or whatever it is. But then it's explained that women can only be in the Navy. They can't be in the infantry, because if you're in the infantry, everyone has to drop. You can't not do combat missions. However, only men can do combat missions. However, only people who've done combat missions and served on the Navy can become commanders. So it's a bit weird how he's either intentionally said that women can't become leaders in the military, which, you know, maybe back in 1959 that was accepted. Maybe. I don't know. To be honest, I don't even know how high women, you know, where the highest ranked woman commander in any army in the world is. You know, I it's not something that I really thought about that much until it came up in this book, but sort of obliquely and not actually mentioned straight away. And the other thing is that, you know, while Heinlein is very good at sort of picking out different technological advances and how they play through in reality, he sort of missed the idea that they would compensate for you know, physical differences between males and females, you know, the physical competencies, well, not competencies, what I'm trying to say, yeah, just abilities, you know, levels of abilities. So that's it. So dismiss women entirely, completely out of hand, and I'm just thinking, you know, Mr. Heinlein, we can do better than that. Anyway, especially if it's set in the future. But again, let's get... Oh, before I get onto the themes, a bit of typical Heinlein writing, very sort of folksy language, is old. Ah, oh, gee, shucks, boy. You know, it was what they called a juvenile novel, you know, written in 1959. It's for teenagers. So I can, you know, I can forgive the... maybe anachronistic... anachronistic, I can't say. Oh, man, my English is getting worse. I've forgotten how to talk these days. But then again, maybe in the future, maybe geez and oh, gee whiz and shucks comes back into fashion. Maybe. Don't know. Worst thing about this. Oh, yeah. But like I say, the writing, pretty good. You know, it's Heinlein. It's not going to be terrible. It's not going to be the most poetic, but it's there. Lloyd James, the narrator, I think great. I really enjoyed his narration of The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. But this really does sound like it was recorded 10 years ago. One, because the quality of the actual recording isn't that great. There was humming in the background. It sounded like an analog recording which hadn't been played back properly when it was being digitized or something like that. And also, Lloyd James, he's just not very good in this. I mean, like I say, 10 years worth of experience maybe as a narrator, and it's just missing there as well. In The Moon and the Harsh Mistress, it was all about the accents. You know, he you know, Manny, the lead character, and that was Russian. So, you know, James was doing like this Russian accent, and then there's other accents coming in and out as well, like because the moon was very multicultural, very diverse, lots of different accents there as well. And then here, Johnny is Chilean, I guess that's probably the better way to say it. And he just had an American accent. Now, it's in the future, and everyone talks English and stuff like that. But then at the end of the book, he sort of says something in some kind of language and said, ah, yeah, that's my old South American Indian heritage coming out there as well. But all the way through, very bland voice, very monotonous and stuff like that. So it was sort of like I was having to enjoy the book despite the bad narration. Thankfully, I enjoyed the book enough that it didn't spoil it completely, whereas, say, Stephen Baxter's Flood, where that was a really bad reading because the reader... He had the words in front of him, and he was mispronouncing words like Chilean for Chilean, and what did I say before? Anachronism. Can't say it. Anyway, I'm just talking off the top of my head. I don't have the script written down in front of me. I know the difference between the word remit and remit. Anyway, yeah, Lloyd James, he could say all the words, it was just a bit bland. Bringing me on to the final section of this podcast, which normally lasts the majority or plurality of the podcast. I talk a lot more about the themes of the novels than actually the writing itself, but this is what I really enjoy about this. So, story of this, meh, you know, characters, meh, action, pretty fun, but sort of relegated to either end of the book. what we really get is an exploration of sort of a few different aspects. One is, of course, the mindset and the journey of the soldier in the military, and it's quite quaint in a way because, like you say, written before the Vietnam War, and obviously before the Forever War by Joe Haldeman, where the Vietnam War sort of returning soldiers, like ex soldiers. They used to be like the returning heroes, and now they're veterans, and it's sort of like the different mindset. And these are definitely heroes. These are definitely war heroes rather than veterans or not yet veterans, because Heinlein discusses sort of like the reasons for joining and the reasons for staying and the reasons for leaving and the reasons for becoming an officer, and it's all so idealized, and all the way through it, like, for example, when Johnny would join a new unit, he immediately drops his old troops from his mind and he becomes one of the new guys, like that. He says at the beginning, it's like, Benny's bootstrap platoon, yeah, for life, yeah, we're the best, we're the greatest, forever, we're all together. And then he swaps to a different movie thingy and he's like, yeah, Chris's Cougars, yeah, that's great, so I'm over here now. And he just switches from one to the other. Like I say, like before, when he goes into the mobile infantry in the first place, he's just like, I didn't want to do this, I can't believe I'm doing this. And then he's like, yeah, this is the best thing in the world, this is the only way to go. And so, and every officer that he meets, they're all officers out of pure altruism, and everyone joins up for the wisest reasons and stuff like that, and of course the leaders are great, and what do you call them, I don't know, it's just the way that not just the leaders in the military, but all the way through the political system and stuff, everyone is just so gracious with everyone else. The non-citizens, they don't have a franchise, and they don't have any say in everything, but they're looked after really well, they pay the taxes, and we look after them really well. I'm like, really? Very idealized from the point of Johnny, and yeah, it's a bit strange. But then again, I really quite like that, because I know people say, oh, this is just war propaganda, but I'm just saying, do you not get it? Like, Johnny has been, he's being led down a path here. He's seeing things from inside the system, and of course he's like this. He's been brainwashed into becoming an officer. Anyway, the overall idea, sort of like the democracy discussion here, like who is... who should have power and who should be able to vote? Now, we just take it for granted that everyone should be able to vote, don't we? Yeah, everyone should be able to vote. That's, that's the way the democracy works. Oh, of course, unless you're under 18. And it used to be, oh yeah, of course you can vote unless you're black or not a landowner or female or not of the right religion or all of these other things. So now we're just settled on this. Oh yeah, everyone's allowed to vote, except if you're under 18. Now, I actually think it's a pretty good thing that people under 18 aren't allowed to vote. But then again, I think it's a pretty bad thing that people over 70 are allowed to vote. Because all they're wanting to do now is, once you've retired, you're just getting stuff out of the system. And, of course, this comes back to my sort of old people not being allowed to put, they're not contributing to society. They're not being forced to go into society. So maybe I'm being just as prejudiced as the people that wanted to email me. But it's sort of like, yeah, people who can't find work, who can't work, yeah, they should be able to should be able to vote. But someone who's worked all their life now and is, it's just one of those things that, I really like the idea in this book, which is just like, yeah, okay, so what do you have to do to be able to vote? Should it be like paying taxes? People who pay taxes can vote. Well, maybe. Not really sure how that works. Because I reckon if that happened, all the people who pay tax would probably make it so the people who don't pay tax yet can't pay tax. Anyway, it's a bit strange. And then you think, well, maybe if you have to own land, you have to vote. So I just really like the idea of a book, which is really a discussion about how much do you have to care, or how much effort do you have to put in to be able to vote? Is just living for 18 years long enough? Well, that's what seems to be agreed these days and stuff like that. So I quite like this. The idea of only people who've enlisted and served for 2 years, it's a fun idea. It's a fun discussion how you can have it. So like, how much, to get the citizens' right to vote, how much work do you have to put in? It means you've got to really, really care. And also, I quite like the idea that the people in the army can't yet vote, because only once you leave can you vote. And if you stay in the army and become an officer, you still can't vote. So actually what happens is that by joining the army, you need to vote. And then by staying in the army, you say, joining the army, you say, hey, I want to be able to vote in the future. And then by staying in the army, you're saying, I don't want to vote for the next 20 years until I've seen out my officer's training and enlisted, an officer's, full tour of duty or however long it is for 20 years that they have to stay in, and then only after then can you leave and vote and stuff. So yeah, the people fighting the wars can't vote to not fight in the wars, but once they're out of the wars, then they won't fight. Then they can vote to send people who are going to fight into the wars. But then it doesn't matter so much because, well, it does matter because they've, yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to explain it all. But like I say, it's all there in the book, and I actually quite like the discussion that goes on about this. The biggest chunk of the book, like I say, is like this taken up with various teachers and other soldiers explaining thoroughly the way that the world works to Johnny. And here's the difference between this book and Atlas Shrugged, because I want to bring it back here, because both of them are very political. This book is a quarter of the length of Atlas Shrugged. I actually read almost twice as much as this book, page what? Well, I listened to this one, but I read Atlas Shrugged. So I read, what, 500 pages of that? And this book is like 200 pages? And yeah, and in that time, you know, Heinlein gets across so many ideas. Of course, a lot of it is just, you know, someone didactically like teaching someone. Johnny going, well, what about this? And then going, ah, in that case, this A, B, C, D, E. And then he goes, well, what about this? And he goes, ah, A, B, C, D, E, F. And then in Atlas Shrugged, all we have is like someone just doing stuff. We had people living out the philosophy in a really weird way. And apparently later on, we get to that, you know, 70, 80, 100 page long speech where John Galt does set out the philosophy. But again, I didn't get to that. And that's a key thing. Another big thing that we can learn from this, when you want to talk about, you know, politics in science fiction or political ideas being put forward or being discussed in fiction, is that, like, if you want me to read your political ideas, first of all, lead off with orbital drops and space battles. That helps. Second of all, make your main character so innocent and ignorant, and you've got to teach that person, like, all the way through. And through that person being taught, you teach me as well. There's no point in, like I say before, Atlas Shrugged, Superman, from birth. They just innately understand everything. And finally, if you're going to write a book with politics in it and stuff like that, if you're going to preach, I don't know how to say this, really. I don't mind preaching at me if you acknowledge that people who think differently to you are humans too. And the example for that is in Atlas Shrugged is like anyone who disagrees with Ayn Rand is evil and should be discarded or just killed or just, you know, is less than human. Literally are being called less than human. The only people who are human are the people who have this sort of like, you know, objectivist kind of philosophy. Whereas here in Starship Troopers, they actually say, this whole idea about only ex-military people being able to have vote and have power and stuff like that. One of the teachers says, look, it's not better than the other systems. It's not worse. It's just what happens. And it's the system that we've got. And it's working so far. So we're just going to stick with it. And I found that really refreshing that they actually just said, everybody voting. Well, that worked for a while. And this kind of system, well, that worked for a while. And this is the system that we've got now. And it's working. We'll see how it goes in the future. And again, quite refreshing. Of course, military dictatorships, they work. Like in a time of war, it's probably good to have some kind of military dictatorship who can actually get you out of it and survive. But then in other situations, probably not quite so much. And also it goes, and the people who don't want to be part of the system, like the people who want to vote, they join up the system and they go through and they get the power. And the people who don't want to vote, well, they just get on with life anyway. And it's explained that, you know, voting, being able to vote, sort of doesn't really help in life very much anyway, and it's probably not worth the cost. Again, we're only getting this from the inside perspective of like the propaganda perspective to Johnny on the inside of this as well. And finally, again, when you're talking about politics in fiction, this is a really big point, is that I don't see this book as propaganda because I don't really think that Heinlein agrees or even believes what he's writing in this book. He doesn't think it should be a manual for how people should live, and he doesn't think it should be the way that the world should work either. It really is like an idealized thought experiment. You know, he's setting out in this book one way that the world could work. He's subtly undermining it in the same way that the moon is a harsh mistress. He has opposite opinions and ethics and politics than he has in this book, because the actual things that are put forward in this book he actually calls objectionable in the moon is a harsh mistress, and vice versa as well. So, you know, the two books are opposed to each other. And also, in different Heinlein books, he talks about different kinds of things as well, like that. Like in Moon is a Harsh Mistress, you know, just one example, people are rebelling against sort of taxation without representation. And in this book, the entire society is built upon the foundation of taxation without representation. And one is told from the point of view of the people rebelling are good, and in this time it's told from the point of view of the people fighting for the system are good. So it's a bit weird that he undermines both of them. Like you say, in The Moon and the Harsh Mistress, it's about a revolution which betrays every one of their espoused ideals in the course of gaining power. So they're talking about freedom and truth and, you know, the power of the people and, you know, the free market and all the different kind of stuff. And every turn, the people, like the professor and Manny and Mike the computer, they undermine those very freedoms and those very, you know, different things, ideals that they're standing for and fighting for. They undermine them every step of the way to get to their goal of those goals, of those, you know, aims. What I'm trying to say. Yeah, so it's a bit weird that here. And in Starship Troopers, we have the opposite, that Heinlein sets up a set of ideals, and yet they're so ideal that they're never undermined in any way. Anything that, you know, there is no badness. Not human badness. That's a really bad way of saying it. There's no human weakness here at all in the book. You know, there is a little bit. Johnny has sort of his doubts, but then he gets over them. And then other people he meets, they always get over it. They're always, you know, nobody ever betrays anybody else in the army. Everyone's great. Everyone's good. The leaders are all great. The leaders are everything. Everyone's ideal. So we've got like two opposing books being told from two points of view with two different sets of characters. One completely ideal, and sort of being undermined in a way by its own idealness. And the other one, the opposite of ideal, they have ideals and then they undermine themselves at every step along the way. Yeah, so there we go. Like, for example, nobody in this book questions about why are we at war with the bugs. It's never answered. You know, nobody questions the politicians or the political leaders or the leaders of the military or everyone like that. Everyone just does their job and they have a completely clear conscience, you know, because it's backed up by this idea of scientific ethics, which is, you know, not right and it's not good, but that's what they have invented in this kind of fascist military dictatorship to keep their soldiers in line. And they can say, look, you're an officer, this is how we're going to work, and that's the way it goes. It reminds me a bit of 1984, where they touch the guy and they go, hey, this is the way it's working, this is the way it's going to go, this is double think, and this is what you need to do, and this is what you need to do. And Winston Smith is just like, what is it? You don't believe this, do you? And it's like, well, it doesn't matter if we believe it or not. This is the way that's being presented to us, and this is the way that we're going to go for it. This is the way that we're going to fight our wars and go through all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that's it, really. I'm just saying, you know, like, Heinlein, in this book, he talks about spanking or physically punishing children. You know, is that the best way to bring them up? Maybe. Does Heinlein think that? Maybe, I'm not sure. You know, I could probably find many passages in other books where he talks about, you know, the complete opposite argument of bringing up children, about being caring and nurturing and stuff like that, and not spanking. And again, like, I can't see Starship Troopers as sort of all polemic, because he's not saying this is the way of the world and everyone else is wrong in black and white terms. Well, he is saying in black and white terms, but he's only saying in the black terms, or only saying in the white terms. He's actually missing out the middle ground, he's hinting at this middle ground, and he's missing out the opposite argument, which is strange, because this is what I really disliked about Atlas Shrugged, is that Atlas Shrugged just dismisses the real world and talks everything about black and white, and, you know, there's nothing there as well. But this book doesn't do that, because because it's so idealized, it's actually saying, no, I'm going to give one point of view of the argument, which will convince this one character in this book, and then what do you think? And it makes you think all the way through, rather than Atlas Shrugged, where they just go, aha, this is right, and you fuck you all if you're wrong. Yeah, and you get the other thing as well, like that. I think Heinlein actually, he allows his other works to refute the sort of like the idealized, you know, hegemony of thought that's presented in this book. For example, like, there's another juvenile novel of his called Space Cadet. It's pretty much the opposite of this story, because it's a young kid who uses his brains all the way throughout rather than weapons, and he has to act by himself at the end. You know, he doesn't just get given orders and carries them out. He's actually put in an isolated situation outside of the chain of command. And also, the sort of like the mobile infantry troops actually turn up in that book. I'm not sure if it's set in the same world, but there's sort of like the cadet sees these sort of gung-ho guys come come in, and they've all got the weapons and everything's like, hey, hey, come on. And they say to him, look, you should come and join up with the, you know, with this Starship Troopers, you know, us mobile infantry. We're the great guys on top of that. And the cadet goes, maybe I should. And then someone takes him aside and says, hey, look, kid, that's not you. You're not like that. You've got more thought than that. You're the guy who can, you know, who could become a leader without. And then, of course, by the end of the book, they, him and some friends, I think, get isolated on a planet, and they have to think by themselves. They are completely out of their comfort zones, and they are taken out of the supporting structure around them, unlike this character who is left in it completely. So if you think this is one thing, maybe read Space Cadet, although it's been probably like 10 years since I've read that book, so I can't remember exactly. Anyway, yeah, this book really is to raise questions about democracy and individuality within a military system, and also what it could be like to be someone who benefits from the inside of sort of, like I say, this mildly, maybe less mildly, you know, fascist military kind of system. You know, it's not that. Oh, talking about this, that. Oh, I made a note here. I can't. Lost my train of thought. Oh yeah, like I say, the point, like I say, is to raise questions, not to answer questions. And I think that's good. This book raises a lot of questions and then goes, well, this is one idea. What do you think? Well, say Atlas Shrugged just says, here are the answers, here are the answers, here are the answers, here are the answers. And if you're an individual, you'll think exactly like I do. Nah, I'm saying that. I'm misrepresenting that, I guess. It's not about just being an individual. It's being about individual, like, only. Fuck it. I can't be bothered to talk about this. Anyway. I meant to put a note here about referencing the movie. I got all the way through here. There is a movie of this book. It's called Starship Troopers. And I remember at the time, I've only seen it once. It was all right. Well, it was a bit shit. No, it was all right. It was fun enough. I actually quite liked the message of Starship Troopers of the book. I think comes through very well in the movie because, like I say, this book is so one-sided and so idealized. They couldn't just represent that on screen because everyone would just go, well, that's what? Eh? Like that. So they have to actually, you know, for example, the characters in the movie has exactly the same thoughts as Johnny Rico. I mean, and the leaders have the same attitude, and the politics is, you know, similar, even though the military and the action is different. You know, the ideas behind it are the same. But of course, as we can see, that we have to question these ideas, and that's what this book was written to do. It's, we have to question these ideas. And thankfully, in the movie, they do question these ideas by sort of ironically commenting on them in a, in like a knowing, tongue-in-cheek look. This can't, it's all campy, isn't it? You know, they actually turn up in the end in sort of like Nazi trench coat kind of get up and things, and the whole thing about the you know, dehumanizing the enemy, because that's what you have in this book. You know, we can only do this, we can only work with the perfect military, and only, you know, Johnny can only work as a perfect soldier if he's not actually killing other humans. If he had to kill other humans, he probably wouldn't, you know, get through it because he's killing bugs. And they actually highlight that even more in the in the movie and stuff like that. And also the line, they sucked out his brains, is one of my all-time favorite bad movie quotes. Anyway, to wrap up this review, the book, it sort of does drag a bit in places. You know, sometimes I would just wish they would stop talking a bit and just get on with it. But, I wanted probably a little bit more action than there was, because, like I say, there's action at the beginning, there's action at the end, and in the middle he goes, well, I've talked about my training, and I won't talk anything more about my training. Anyway, here's a little bit more about my training. We have another two chapters or whatever it is of him training. And then when he stops training, the thing that happened in the flashback, the thing that happened at the beginning of the book, the flashback catches up with it, so we skip over the action, and then he goes into officer's training. So it's just like, oh, for goodness sake, we could have probably told this a little bit differently. But it's pretty good. You know, it kept up my interest even throughout, because, like I say, the ideas that are being presented, while I disagree with most of them, they're good at thinking. And like I say, Heinlein lets me respectfully disagree with the ideas that he probably doesn't even believe himself, but yet is presenting in this book. And I think that's the way to do it if you're going to do some kind of politics in science fiction or in literature. So there's my point here. I wanted this to be a little bit of a contrast to the Atlas Shrugged review. That's why I wanted to do that one before this one. Anyway, so 3.5 stars, might as well. Low sort of 3.5, 3.2. Nah, let's call it 3.5, because I did enjoy reading it. Like I say, I've enjoyed books. I probably wouldn't have read this book again, except it was an audiobook, and I'm going back through some classic books that I've read a few times before as paper books, and now checking them out as audiobooks. I saw Dune there as well. I was thinking, oh, I could do Dune, but I realised I've actually read that and reviewed it for this podcast already. Maybe I'll just do an audiobook version of it. Anyway, next book that I'm reading, talking about some classics, The City and the Stars by Arthur C. Clarke. I think this is my first Arthur C. Clarke book that I'm going to review on here. I'm more than halfway through it already, so look forward to that review, because I'm looking forward to reviewing it. Email me, luke@juggler.net. Like I say, I reply to every email, or the vast majority of emails. Especially if you ask me a question, I will reply to the question. If you just have a comment, I guess sometimes I might not reply, or I'll put it to reply and then leave it too long and then it's not worth it. Or I'll reply on the podcast or something like that. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on Twitter. You can check out everything I do on my blog, which is called lukeburge.com/blog, and you can read my fiction there as well, lukeburge.com/fiction. You can read my own take on military science fiction, which is called Combat, which is a little bit postmodern self-referential title, but hey, it's there anyway. You can read it. It's a follow-up to my first novel, Mining Tomorrow, but you don't need to read that first novel to get into it. And in there, I sort of set out, well, to be honest, it sort of tells a little bit about my father's story as a military officer and his journey through being in the army and then finding religion and leaving the army and consequences of fighting and shooting people for a living, which my father had to live through. So he's had an interesting story. And that's sort of maybe one quarter of the storyline in that book, but it's there anyway. And I'm very proud of that book. So check it out if you want my own take on military science fiction. Otherwise, best thing to do, get onto goodreads.com, become my friend or follow my reviews. And like I say, on the sfbrp.com website, there's links to every book that I've reviewed. So you can check them out on goodreads.com and recommend books on there. And also, when I review a book, oh, this is what I always do. I've got the page open here. Let me check it out. Goodreads.com, I've got the Starship Troopers. 64 other people have reviewed this book, and it's rated 3.72 average, which is pretty close to my, 3.5 average. So here, not much to say about the book that has been talked to death. Do not let the movie of the same name deter you. Do yourself a favor and pick up this classic and enjoy. That's Brian says that. Scroll down a bit here. Who else says something? Cameron wrote a long review. I'm not going to do this. Nope, not many people have written stuff. I'm not going to read anything like that. But generally, good. It gets a good reaction from the listeners to this science fiction book review podcast. I was trying to find a low review, but the only low reviews I can find haven't written a review. Oh, Glenn Schmiesel. It's too long, though, as well. So I'm not going to go into that. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.